They made you be born in a manger, Lord, sweet little holy child. Didn't know who you was.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Open Up, a benefit supporting Outside In on Wednesday, December 6th at 9 p.m. at the Laurel Thirst Public House in Portland. Open Up features musical artists Q Bala, Nicole Morton, and Jenny Jolly, as well as spoken word poets, guest speakers, and a silent auction. Again, that's Open Up, a benefit supporting Outside In on Wednesday, December 6th at 9 p.m. at the Laurel Thirst Public House, 2958 Northeast Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good afternoon, KBOO. Actually, it's still morning. KBOO listeners, the time is 11:30 and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Up next, Art Focus. You'll be hearing from Joseph Galavan, but then after that at noon, stick around for our Spanish language programming. We have Buscando America from noon until 1:30, followed by Fa Radio from 1:30 to 2:30, and then from 2:30 to 4, we have Radio Tonali. So we thank you for listening, and for those of you who are members, thank you. For those of you who are not, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
Andy Wawa looks a scream, have him on my wall.
My name is Joseph Galavan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Jeannie Kenmotsu. She is the Japan Foundation Assistant Curator of Japanese Art at the Portland Art Museum, and she's here to talk about the show Craftsmanship and Wit, Modern Japanese Prints from the Carol and Seymour Haber Collection, which runs now until April the 1st, 2018. Thanks for coming into KBOO, Jeannie.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're new at the museum, and this show is all prints. People can find it in the back on the Asian Gallery side, so kind of behind the Leica stuff for now on the left. Right. And you have one room. You go into the room. It's all frame prints on the walls. There are four things in vitrines. One of them that caught my eye immediately was by a guy called Takeda Hideo. And it's a man. It looks like he's got a man bun. And he's being attacked by a dog. And this dog has cut his leg. And he's pulling on the man's belt from his sort of traditional Japanese garb. Anyway, just tell us a bit about this. This show is all about prints, and this is a kind of a striking colored on gray print with a white dog.
Yeah, this is the only screen print in the exhibition. And so it has these really bright, almost neon kind of colors. It comes from a portfolio that Takeda did titled Mon Mon, which means like pattern pattern. So there's a kind of play on words that's happening. And if you look at his body, and you can see this better with the full portfolio, they're all tattooed figures. And then he's got this really fabulous patterned robe that he's tied around his waist. Probably it was like it was over his shoulders, and he's thrown it off his shoulders, and it's now down around his waist. They're all these kind of like tattooed tufts, is how I think of them. They're really kind of like muscular guys, and they've got all these tattoos all over them. But it's quite humorous in the whole series, so there's a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek play going on.
So this is one screen print of a series of screen prints about these characters.
Yeah, and he has this style that's really interesting. So he's sort of drawing on traditional imagery in Japanese prints, to some degree, of like warrior prints is kind of the older tradition, as well as he has a kind of cartoon illustration like quality to how he does his screen print work.
What era is this from?
Oh, I think that's from the 70s.
The 1970s.
Yeah.
Okay, so he's taken figure style that goes back to what kind of era?
Well, it's kind of like the style of the figure is more like we think of modern graphics and cartoons, but the figure itself is sort of drawing on older warrior images.
Mm-hmm. And is he tattooed?
He is. So it almost looks like a shirt. Right? Yeah.
But it's just he's respectable and hasn't done his arms.
I think he's maybe not so respectable, right? Because right. he's got these tattoos, so he's kind of a sort of a, there's a little bit of a gangster figure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so why is he screen printing? Do you think that's an American influence or European influence? What's going on in the 70s?
By the 70s, Japanese artists are working in a huge range of different kinds of printmaking processes. So he certainly spent a little bit of time in the United States and has an audience here, certainly, and in Europe. But screen printing practices were already pretty underway, by the 70s, 80s in Japan. I think it's just a style that he finds really conducive for his work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's another piece. There are two pieces. One of them is called sort of homage to Oldenburg, meaning Klas Oldenburg.
Right.
And that's what the artist misnames him knowingly. It's a button and a piece of rope and something else.
And a clothespin.
Clothespin.
Yeah.
So they look like crayon drawing. Well, what medium is this?
So this is mezzotint, which is a pretty labor-intensive intaglio printmaking process, meaning it would go through a rolling press. And mezzotint is time-consuming because you have a plate, right, a metal plate, and you rock it all over with a rocking tool so that you've pitted the whole surface with these kind of microscopic dots so that were you to ink that plate and print it, it would print fully black. So then you burnish out, you smooth out areas where you want the white of the paper to show. So you're kind of working in reverse in some ways. You're bringing out the image from the darkness effectively, which is why it's so time consuming. And most mezzotints that you see, I mean, traditionally they tend to be on the smaller side, partly because it's so time consuming. But there are three mezzotints in the show, including the homage to Oldenburg, which are quite large, given the technique. He's an interesting artist. This is Hamanishi Katsunori. He's still working today. He chose this subject because he lived in Philadelphia for, I think, a year. He had a residency at the University of Pennsylvania. And Philadelphia has all of these great public monuments or public sculptures that Klas Oldenburg designed. So the button, this broken button, is out in front of the library at the University of Pennsylvania. And the big clothespin is sitting out in a public square. So this was kind of like his memories of some of his time there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a kind of like art reference there, even if it looks now almost like a crayon drawing, mm-hmm. as you say.
It's a colored print, but it's very soft. Mm-hmm. The colors are muted and the lines are very kind of gauzy. But he has another piece, which is just red rope,
mm-hmm.
Sort of curled up and twisted in a long sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what that's called?
I think it's called Crevice Number 4. That imagery where he has these kind of twigs or branches that look really dry and broken that are wrapped in this crimson rope, that is a recurring motif that he worked through for quite a number of years, and it still kind of appears in some of the mezzotints that he's doing now. I think one of the things that's amazing about those is that they look so real. I mean, they look so three-dimensional. I think that's one of the reasons that he returned to it over and over. And they're kind of enigmatic. They kind of, you know, sort of like there's something a little bit not sinister necessarily, but there's a real ambiguity about what's being tied you know, is there confinement happening? Is it a tied bundle? Like, what's really being depicted there? Mm-hmm. And he gives them these titles that don't necessarily make that clear what the subject is.
Would a piece like that, the rope piece, be done? How many? An edition of how many? And who would end up getting them? Do you have any idea?
I have cataloged that, so I don't know off the top of my head. I don't right. remember off the top of my head the edition number, but he does work in editions, usually of fair size.
Yeah, I mean, what would an artist like that, why would he be making prints? You know, is it because he has a good gallery demanding them, or, you know, he does some other medium and he just prints on the side? Do you have any sense of...
Well, Hamanishi in particular is really a mezzotint specialist. I believe he may do some painting and drawing as well, but I think primarily he works in prints. That is his medium. I know that he was already working and trained as a printmaker in Japan, but when he was invited to do the residency in Philadelphia, he was represented by... I think Gilbert Luber and maybe another dealer in Philadelphia at the time. This would have been like the, you have to cut this, I don't know, the 80s or something, mm-hmm. 90s. And he has an audience here in the United States. I mean, I met someone the other day who said, oh, I have a nice Hamanishi that I really like here in Portland. So
there's another mezzotint, which is just of an owl flying. It's very small. It's like 5x4. Mm-hmm. And it's this beautiful, soft owl. It's black and white. You know, the owl's white. He's right. in mid-fly, or she. Just tell us about that mezzotint. That's sort of very, you know, it's like a miniature. What? Mm-hmm. Who did that, and why would they be doing it in that manner?
So this is an artist named Sakamoto Koichi, who I think is a little bit better known for color mezzotints. But this one I was really drawn to because of exactly what you're describing, the kind of softness of it. I mean, it's almost like nature photography where someone has taking a picture of an owl at night mm-hmm. with a special lens.
Yeah, yeah.
And capturing it. There's something like illuminated, like it's about to plunge down on a mouse or something. But to do that in print, I mean, with printmaking, you're already removed from the artist's hand in terms of what they might have drawn, you know, directly with a pencil or paint or whatever. So there's something really extraordinary about being able to bring that lightness and that sort of like spark of a flash like that out of the darkness of a black mezzotint plate.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful piece. Somebody called Junichiro has three pieces which are fascinating. One's called White Rooster. It's a portrait of a boy holding a rooster, like hugging it. The woman who is on the cover of the guide that comes with the show, a girl in a traditional dress but brightly colored. She's sitting in profile and looking kind of not looking happy or sad, just, you know, not a traditional expression. And then he has this picture of a Catholic church. So tell us about the artist.
So this is Sekino Junichiro, Sekino being his family name. This would be a pretty familiar name to some American collectors. He has been really well appreciated here in the United States and had a wonderful, actually, relationship to Portland, or at least to Oregon, that I'll tell you about. So he works in woodblock, or worked in woodblock printing. So virtually every color that you see in his prints represents a different block.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can count, you know, 27 colors, he's used. If he hasn't used 27 separate blocks, it's at least 27 separate pulls mm-hmm. from blocks. Maybe there's 16 or something. So you can imagine that that's pretty labor intensive. He's carving the blocks himself, often printing them himself, although he also worked with a printer sometimes. And I love these two portraits, which are actually of his children when they were younger. He is also known for landscape and other kinds of subjects, but the collectors knew the artist personally, and they really were drawn to some of his early portraits. And they're quite large scale, so you can imagine the size of the mm-hmm. blocks involved yeah. as well. But the way that he plays with color, with a, you know, these are very recognizably figures. They're, you know, but there's still a kind of abstraction that's going on that you can see with how he's layering color and playing with the planes, really, of the surface. So you get a kind of three-dimensionality just out of the use of color, which mm-hmm. I think is really extraordinary.
The girl who's looking to the right has a shadow on her face, the front of her face, and it looks like a watercolor. Mm-hmm. How's he done that with block? You know,
right, printing? It's extraordinary, isn't it? So that is another block that he's used, probably two, sort of one for the slightly darker, or he's created a graduated color, sort of, if you think about it as kind of like doing a wash on the block and then printing it.
Mm-hmm. How does he apply the paint to the block?
He would use traditional techniques where you would dab on, and then maybe if you were going to create a kind of wash or graduated effect like that, a gradation, you would wipe it in a specific kind mm-hmm. of way.
So you put it on with a brush, but you could wipe it with a rag, maybe?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Exactly. There are traditional brushes that are used in woodblock printing. Of course, artists can use all kinds of other tools today mm-hmm. and throughout yeah. the 20th century, but there's a reason that for 300 years, Japanese woodblock print artists use largely the same tools, that they're so effective.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So when I think of Japanese woodblock, I think of a very strong tradition. How much is he breaking with tradition?
So the incredible scale of these portraits is, I mean, totally different. You know, a standard size for a 18th, 19th century Japanese woodblock print is what, like a letter or A4 size sheet of paper, roughly, a little bit larger. You might have triptychs, you might have a few, you know, other large sizes, but they're generally much, much smaller. So that's one way. The fact that he's carving himself is a real difference. So the
oh, yeah?
kind of traditional setup for traditional, historically, for Japanese woodblock printmaking is you have the artist, what we call the artist, who was effectively the designer, right, of the print. You have the carver, who just does the carving. You have the printer, who just does the printing. And then you have a publisher who oversees all of it. And in a lot of cases, you know, we call the artist because those are the terms that we have sort of developed in the West. But in a lot of cases, it might have been the publisher who really represents the kind of intention and the kind of decision-making about, you know, what colors, what's the subject, what do I want you to draw? Of course, there are other cases earlier where artists are making some of those decisions. Hokusai is one of them. We know that he wrote to his publisher and said, "I only want this carver because he translates my designs right. So I want him to do it." But what happened in the early 20th century is there was this group of artists who championed. It was called the Creative Print Movement, or Sosaku Hanga. And they were really influenced by particularly European ideas of self-expression. So they championed this idea that what we're going to do is we're going to self-carve and we're going to self-print. So jigoku jizuri is what they would say. So that was a real change. I mean, for artists not just to design the prints and maybe check the proofs, but to learn to carve yourself, right, and especially to work in color, so you're talking about multiple blocks, was a total change from the previous system. And Sekino was mentored by several of the leaders and the pioneers in that movement, and definitely picked up a lot of their working process and their ethos
mm-hmm.
Over time.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Jeannie Kenmutsu. She is the Japan Foundation Assistant Curator of Japanese Art at the Portland Art Museum. And she's here talking about a show of Japanese prints, which is going on now, called Craftsmanship and Wit. And that runs through April the 1st, 2018. So Jeannie, we were just talking about this artist who does colored block prints, but in a 20th century influence style. He also did a series about different roads, correct, in Japan?
Yeah.
And you have one of them there, and it's a picture of a church. So why would he be going out doing roads? Actually, sounds like the kind of thing people here would do, right? And what's the church?
So this, again, is Sekino Junichiro, and he, you may have heard of some rather famous series of traditional woodblock prints, like called the 53 Stations of the Tokaido Road.
Mm-hmm.
This was possibly the most popular series in Japanese printmaking of all time. It was virtually in continuous production by different publishers, and all kinds of artists did it after, you know, Hiroshige had done it. So Sekino did a version of that at some point in his career, but he also was interested in doing not just famous roads, but also roads that were really familiar to him, roads that no one else, you know, the alley behind his house or, you know, that kind of thing. If you imagine like the roads that you know, right, you know, your commute to work or the roads from was visiting grandma's house.
Was he doing this to be punk rock?
I don't know. I don't think so necessarily. Others in the show, I think we're doing that. Takeda, for instance, is definitely more of a punk rock kind of guy.
Okay.
Sekino, though, this series of roads, there's a print in the show that shows the Catholic church of this town called Tsuwano, and it's really extraordinary. He's got in there, I think it's like 20-something different colors, incredible gradations. There's apparently gold pigment mixed into the yellows and things. So it really took incredible care to produce this. And it comes from a portfolio with a book of reproductions of his whole series of his Nihon no Kaido, or his Japanese streets, Japanese roads.
And is that what's in the box in the vitrine?
Yeah, that's what's in the
box.
Okay,
so you pulled one out of the box. Out of his portfolio.
So this print was made specially to go with the book and the portfolio. The book itself, though, is reproduces his paintings and his prints of roads. So it's still a limited edition book, but it contains, you know, mass publisher reproductions mm-hmm. of his work, but not this print. This print was pulled specifically for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a show of, you know, prints on the wall, but there are these four vitrines. One of them has that you were just talking about, a print and a book. Another piece is called Red Clay Surface, and it looks like an old, if you can imagine the shape of an old Hewlett Packard monitor, a flat screen when they were still square about 15 years ago. Imagine that shape. It's on a little pedestal, mm-hmm. but it's brown ceramic, it's kind of like two layers, and then there are these seven rows of 7x7 little red bumps on the front and the back. They look like match heads poking out,
mm-hmm.
and it's completely abstract. It's like, mm-hmm. what is this thing?
Mm-hmm.
And tell us, what was that artist thinking?
So this is Sasayama. He's really interested in surfaces, as you might imagine, which for me really spoke to a lot of the prints that I had chosen for the show. Really interested in evoking the artist's hand and kind of, you know, I'm sorry, this is one that's hard for me to talk about because I don't know him that well.
Oh, okay.
I chose it partly in contrast to the other ceramic piece in the show, which is by Fukami Sueharu.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, it's not a celadon glaze on this surface, but it almost looks like it. If you imagine that pale blue, green, white kind of color that you get in, particularly Korean ceramics are famed for this. Ceramic artists all over the world have
celadon.
Celadon, okay. Yeah. Fukami's process is totally different, and the result is totally different than the Sasayama mm-hmm. red clay surface, where you get this utterly smooth surface where he's just almost effaced his hand from the surface of the piece. He fires it at really high pressure, it's created in a high pressure mold. It's a slip cast clay. And he then carves away at the surface to get this totally smooth, kind of glass-like, almost reflective surface. So there's a real... demonstrates a kind of real different sensibility.
So the one that looks like a brown computer monitor is kind of rough to touch. Mm-hmm. But the one by Fukami, what's his name?
Fukami Sueharu.
His piece is called Heavenly Void. Mm-hmm. And it's this incredibly elegant pointed shape that looks like it's flying. It looks like a dolphin, piece of a dolphin or the Concorde airplane or something that's in several different planes. It's curved, it's pointed, it's thin, it's thick. It's on this wooden plinth thing and it has a little ceramic blob kind of key kind of holding it up or holding it in.
Yeah.
It's incredible. And like you said, there is no trace of a human hand. It's so smooth and the colors are so delicate. So you chose them as a contrast.
Yeah, what I love about them is that I think what they share is they both seem to invite our hand. I mean, obviously these are protected by in the vitrine, so we can't actually do that. But you can imagine that if you had them in your home, you would want to touch them all the time and feel those surfaces and the edges and the contours of them. And would they be cold? Would they be warm?
Why are they in the show of prints?
So for a couple of reasons. So one, I wanted to kind of give you something except beyond flat objects on the wall, but also because this is a show that reflects a collection that was built by Carol and Seymour Haber over a number of decades, who gave significant gifts. These are all gifts to the museum or promised gifts. And it really reflects their interest in craftsmanship of an extraordinarily high quality, but they had diverse tastes. And I think that that's a really nice way to also show the diversity in modern Japanese art. I think commonly we have certain expectations for what Asian art looks like or for even what modern Asian art looks like. And I think that the diversity of what artists are exploring, who their connections are, what are their techniques, is constantly, you know, even for me, a specialist in the field, it can be a real surprise and a delight. And they were collectors, the Habers, who really, I think, appreciated that and followed their own interests within that diverse sort of field. But it's a nice way to tell that story as well.
About are they the 20th from century. Portland?
Yeah, they were long time. Seymour was a doctor and Carol was a nurse, and they were married for a very, very long time and here in Portland and wonderful supporters of the museum. Like, I think Carol was a docent as well.
Mm-hmm. Are they still alive?
Unfortunately, they have passed. I was fortunate to meet their son and two daughters-in-law recently, and they were, I think, quite glad to see the works being shared with the public.
It's a beautiful show. I mean, you've got one room and you do an amazing job of showing us so many different things. You're sort of from the Japan Foundation, right? You arrived in June. This show was already sort of slated, but you took it over and, you know, made it happen. Why are you here?
So I'm not from the Japan Foundation, but they are generous supporters of my existence here in Portland. I arrived in June because the museum was awarded a very significant grant from the Japan Foundation to support my position and the renovation, we hope, of the Japanese galleries over the next 5 years. I am here at least for 5 years as the assistant curator of Japanese art.
Mm-hmm. But you have free run over the print collection and Japanese art.
So I have primary responsibility for the Japanese print collection, which is by far the largest area of among the Asian collections. We have... depends on how you count the numbers, but let's say close to 3,000 Japanese prints, which is not the most enormous compared to some big behemoths we have on the East Coast or like the British Museum. But what's interesting is we have some really special things here in Portland, things that were collected on the West Coast that were not collected elsewhere.
Like what? Can you drop some names in the last 30 seconds?
Absolutely. Suzuki Harunobu is regarded as one of the first great printmasters of full color printmaking. We have an impression of his where no other impressions of this are known in the world, including in Japan today, and a number of other similar one of a kind pieces. And that he's from 1765, so this is pretty early.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we can look forward to more interesting shows of Japanese art at the museum.
Absolutely.
In the next few years.
Absolutely. I wanted to make a splash with some of the modern prints this time around, but I think the next rotation, the next exhibition that I do will be of traditional Japanese prints.
Mm-hmm. My name's Joseph Gallivan. I've been talking to Jeannie Kenmotsu, the Japan Foundation Assistant Curator of Japanese Art at the Portland Art Museum, talking about craftsmanship and wit. Full title, Modern Japanese Prints from the Carolyn Seymour Haber Collection. It runs through April the 1st, 2018 at the Portland Art Museum. Thank you so much for coming into KBOO, Jeannie.
Thanks so much. This is fun.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Andy, moan, now, whoa, 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 whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Good afternoon, KBOO listeners. The time is 12 o'clock. My name is Tave Fache Drake, and I'm going to be turning it over to Luna Flores for Buscando America, sitting in for Tanya Gomez Daza. We have Buscando America from noon till 1:30, 1:30 to 2:30, Fa Radio, and then 2:30 to 4 o'clock, Radio Tonale. After that, we have Democracy Now!, and then KBOO's very own independently produced news. So stick around, and Buscando America will be up after these announcements.